This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. I need your help with something. I need to come up with an analogy or a metaphor or some variation in between those two so that will help people understand how consequential it is that when a 7-year-old kid comes up to Scott Walker and says, "Are you concerned about climate change?" that rather than saying yes or no or here's my concern, Scott Walker goes off on this rant about I was a Boy Scout kid. And then the kid says, "Do you even care about climate change?" And Scott Walker basically says no. I mean, basically, he says nothing. I mean, he's got nothing to say. This is an example. We talk about regulatory capture. You know, like there was some concern for some time that the FCC, for example, the Federal Communications Commission, had been captured by the agencies, the companies that it regulates, that, you know, it regulates the internet. The internet service providers didn't want to have common carrier status Title II. They wanted to make sure that they could still, that they could ramp up their efforts to extract more cash from average working Americans and, you know, basically screw us on the internet end of things. So where I need your help on this, you know, this is so consequential thing is, what is this like? Right. Is this like getting a member of the United States? You get the head of the Environment and Public Works Committee. You get James Inhofe denying that climate change exists when he's in charge of the committee that's supposed to do something about climate change for the United States. Now, just think for a minute about how consequential that is. Now, at the same time, you got Bibi Netanyahu, who just came to office in Israel. And the same kind of thing is happening there, except that in the United States, our Supreme Court has said individual billionaires can simply buy the politician of their choosing simply by using super PACs and things like that. In Israel, they actually say you can't do that. You can't buy a politician. So what's a billionaire to do? Well, Sheldon Adelson went over to Israel and started a free newspaper. I believe he started it. Maybe he bought one. I'm not sure. But it is now the most widely circulated newspaper in Israel. It is free. So it's just like Fox News here in the United States. Widely circulated, free, and unabashedly hard right. So Shelley Adelson actually won the election for Netanyahu, and he helped him here in the United States by apparently leaning on Boehner and friends and saying, you know, you will make life good for Mr. Netanyahu here. And for that matter, leaning on Tom Cotton. So what, you know, again, here we have this extraordinary influence of money. So what would be the analogy or the metaphor? Would it be this is stranger than a politician saying that that, you know, days are dark and nights are bright? Would it be, I mean, can you imagine if a politician got up and said, you know, I don't think that tobacco causes cancer? Well, up until about 25 years ago, virtually all Republican politicians said that, and a lot of Democratic politicians said that, because the tobacco industry had thrown all this money into this thing. If you haven't seen this movie, Merchants of Doubt, it is astonishing, and it's really worth going to see. I sent a note yesterday to Louise and Sean saying, let's book these folks as guests. You know, so I want to get them on and promote their movie because it's really amazing. But it's basically how the tobacco industry is doing this. So how do we communicate that to somebody? I mean, consider if conventional wisdom. Okay, well, actually, there's some actual examples out there. Conventional wisdom is that climate change is happening. Republican wisdom is that it's not. Okay. Or at least it's not caused by human beings. Conventional wisdom is that, you know, 9/11 was caused by Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and, you know, those guys hijacking planes and crashing them into the World Trade Center. But what if the Republican point of view was that, no, 9/11 was actually done by, I don't know, liberals? I mean, can you imagine if a member of the United States Senate or the House of Representatives got up and questioned the details of 9/11? Now, the science and the history, you know, the knowledge that we have, the level of knowledge we have about what happened on 9/11 and what led to 9/11. And that's just an example that I just pulled out of my left ear. I mean, you know, I'd like to hear your suggestions. But the science behind climate change is actually more comprehensive than the science behind what happened on 9/11. There's a lot more scientists working on it for a lot more time, and they've got really, really solid results. So you have now basically the end of American democracy. Right? I don't know how to define this beyond that. The end of American democracy. And then on top of that, we've got a lot going on. You know, the House budget just said the Republicans in the House, of course, Iowa is a farm state, and it's an early Republican primary state. The average farm income in the United States, average family income in the United States in general is around 50 grand a year. Average farm income is around 115,000 a year. The Republicans chose to cut farm support programs for poor people, specifically largely children, specifically food stamps, by over $140 billion. Cutting farm supports, not so much. $1 billion over 10 years. Shortchange the nation's most needy, as Carrie Elveld says over at Daily Kos. But do you get the point that I'm making here? That our system has been so corrupted in such an astonishing way. I mean, if 15, 20 years ago somebody had come along and said, you know, the day is going to come when there is clear science that the world is being ruined by one particular industry, by the fossil fuel industry. I mean, this isn't like 30 years ago coming out and saying, you know, a million people a year are dying worldwide because of one particular industry, the tobacco industry. This is even more consequential. This is not just smokers at risk. This is the entire planet. And what if 30 years ago somebody said, and the day is going to come when virtually every Republican politician out there will deny that the planet is warming up as a result of human activity. And if they refuse to deny it, they get knocked out of office and Trey Gowdy replaces them. I mean, that's actually what happened. The guy that Trey Gowdy replaced was a Republican who said, hey, wait, you know, he went down to Antarctica and he came back and he said, I've seen the science. This is real. And boom, he's out. He's gone. So can you imagine, I mean, if somebody 30 years ago had told me that someday Republicans would be saying this and actually making policy based on this, telling individual states not to use the phrase climate change, an actual effort at the part of the federal government level, and we saw this with Ted Cruz the other day interrogating the head of NASA, to say, you guys shouldn't be looking into climate change, right? I mean, you're just science for the U.S. government that has to do with atmosphere.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is like we have stepped into a very, very bizarre world, a world lacking small-d democracy. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Brian in Fitchburg, Mass., watching Free Speech TV on, it says public. Not sure what that is, Brian.
Yeah, how are you doing, Tom?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm trying to get them to, you know, we have our local TV station, and I can see it from midnight to 6 in the morning, but I'm trying to get the local to put it on, you know, when you're on.
Okay.
But I noticed you, but I'm just calling you. Yeah, I watched the program on how all the killer whales are going way north now to kill seals because the water temperature is so warm.
Right. And the seals are starving because the anchovies that they normally eat have gone farther out to sea for more looking for colder waters.
Yeah. And Tom, there's one question I'd like to ask you. You know, back when Reagan was president, did he make it so that the federal government was responsible for home loans?
I don't know. I know that FDR did that. I mean, that's how FDR saved American homeowners back in the 30s, was he, because most people at that time had five-year mortgages with, you know, balloon payments at the end of 5 years, and that was fine with everybody because housing prices have been going up so much, people were playing the housing market, so they'd buy a house for 2 or 3 years, turn it, you know, flip it, make some money, and sell it.
Right.
And what FDR did was he bought all those five-year mortgages and replaced them with 30-year mortgages at a lower interest rate, which allowed that an entire generation of Americans to stay in their homes who otherwise would have been kicked out. So.
Oh, I thought back when Reagan was president, they made it so I thought the banks were responsible for those mortgages, and then Reagan made a pass where the government would be.
Well, I could, you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are backstopping the banks. They used to be federal agencies, and they would loan money to the banks and you know, for housing, and then the banks would cycle that money out. They were privatized. I don't, you know, I'd have to get somebody on who knows the history of Fannie and Freddie, Brian. I just don't.
Back in 95, you could buy an average house for about $60,000.
Right.
And you made more money back than an average salary than it is today. Mm. And today they want $300,000 for a house.
Yeah.
I mean, everything's gone up. Auto insurance tripled, property taxes tripled, health care's tripled, and minimum wage is only $7 an hour.
Right.
I mean, it should be $21 an hour to keep up with inflation.
I agree. Actually, 21 would keep up with productivity. Around 16 would keep up with inflation. But yeah, I totally agree with you. And these are, and thanks, Brian, for the call. These are really serious issues that we need to pay attention to. I'm still curious, though. You know, what's a good metaphor for how incredibly insane these Republicans have gone, that they're denying something that's happening right in front of all of our faces, and that they're actually able to get the suckers in the Republican Party, the useful idiots, to go along with it? I mean, this is astonishing. How do they do that? So, anyhow, we'll continue this conversation in just a few minutes. It is 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Other things in the news, you know, this we are looking at the right wingification of the world. I mean, what happened in Israel last night was a demonstration of how effective it is when the media is owned by industry, or when the media is owned by billionaires, and how, you know, what kind of public policy you get as a result of that. Here in the United States, our media is owned, with a few small exceptions like Pacifica or Free Speech TV. By and large, our media is owned by billionaires or multi-multimillionaires and very large corporations. That's who owns the media in the United States. And in Israel, the largest media is owned by Shelley Adelson, you know, this newspaper, and it just unabashedly supporting Netanyahu, and it's free. They give it out to everybody. And yet that's not considered campaign support by Israeli election law. See, what this demonstrates is how fragile democracy is, small d democracy, how easily democracy is corrupted by big money. This was something the founders took on. You know, Thomas Jefferson spoke out a number of times about how perfidious, how destructive big money could be. He said that when wealth becomes so great that it challenges the state, that it should be diminished by the law of equal inheritance, increasing about a geometric ratio. I mean, Jefferson was basically, you know, tax it all. You don't want a landed gentry running your country. And yet that's what we've got. Here we are now. Meanwhile, Ray Dalio, if I'm saying it right, D-A-L-I-O, maybe it's Dalio. He runs a $165 billion hedge fund called Bridgewater Associates. And he sent out a note today to his investors that the Financial Times picked up that said, oh, this is interesting. His note pointed out that in 1933, you had the great crash in 1929. In 1933, Roosevelt became president. The Fed started loosening the monetary, whatever you call it, policy, I guess, and printing money, as it were, a loose money policy, sort of like we did with quantitative easing. They stopped that in 1937, and it was too soon. They really needed to do it another 4 or 5 years, but they stopped it in 1937, and the result was a two-year recession because the Fed raised interest rates too early. And Ray Dalio is saying, you know, that 1937 scenario, which happened 8 years after the great crash. Well, we're now 8 years after this last great crash, and please don't do the same thing you did 8 years after the last great crash. This is a very, very interesting story. So, you know, we'll see where it goes, where this whole thing goes. The other falling into the category of, you know, my comment about the Republican Party, it's made up of rich people and suckers. And periodically the rich people have to reach out to the suckers and bring them in and hold them tight so that they'll continue voting for Republican politicians who generally are not rich people, but owe their lives and fortunes and futures to rich people. You know, the Scott Walkers of the world. Although some of them are rich people, you know, Jeb Bush is a rich guy. Scott Walker, multimillionaire. Excuse me, Rick Scott down in Florida. I might get my Scotts mixed up. So the latest reach out to the basically fearful white guy crowd by the Republicans, because, you know, they've got to reach out to these white suckers. Keep in mind, the Republican Party has two kinds of people in it, rich people and suckers. And every now and then, the rich people have to reach out to the suckers and say, don't worry, we're looking out for you. And, you know, I remember in the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, when I was a kid, the Republicans would talk about how black people, when they're talking to white people, which is, you know, typically when Republicans are talking, they're talking to white people. And they would say, you know, the black people are coming to get your job. The black people want to take your son's college slot. Right. The whole, you know, affirmative action thing. Well, now the Republicans are saying, oh, no, it's not the black people. It's the brown people. They want to take your job. Six Republican senators. Ben Sasse of Nebraska, apparently a ringleader in this thing. Republican. Six Republican senators, writes Esther Hussey Lee over at Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org. Six Republican senators introduced a bill Monday that would prohibit the government from issuing Social Security numbers to undocumented immigrants protected under the president's executive action on deportation relief. Really? I mean, you're just going to slap. It's like, yes, we have to reach out to those white Republican racists. You know, we've got to make sure that they know that we're just like, the Republican Party, we're here for a white America, not for anything else. So anyhow, I'll pick up your calls, your suggestions about an analogy. I mean, who would have believed 20, 30 years ago that the entire Republican Party in Congress would deny actual science that's right here in front of us for all of us to see. Who could have believed it? What else could be this weird?
Cracking the Code explains how to discuss and debate with conservatives. Somebody today will get a free copy when they call into the show.
So we'll be back with your calls on this right after that. Or on that right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So did you see this story? China targets big oil in wars on corruption and pollution. Over the last past 2 years, anti-corruption squads have investigated dozens of high-ranking officials in coal and oil bureaucracies. With the latest detention announced Monday night, the vice chairman of China National Petroleum Corp, Liao Yongman, was placed under investigation. Why can't we have oil companies being investigated in the United States? Oh, that's right. They own politicians. They're allowed to own politicians. The Supreme Court encourages them to own politicians. Why is it that Scott Walker lives in fear of a seven-year-old? Seven-year-old comes up to him and says, what do you think about climate change? Scott Walker goes, well, I was a Boy Scout. And the kid goes, you don't even care about climate change, do you? And Walker's like, next. I mean, this is what they have to do. And the libertarians want to make it even worse. They want even more billionaires and big corporations to be able to buy even more of people like Scott Walker. It's amazing. John, in Punta Gorda, Florida. Hey, John, you got an analogy for me?
Possibly. Not really literally an analogy, Tom. But it goes to the kind of summing up this class of people who seem to want to avoid the subject altogether. And I think deep down inside, maybe they believe that it's inevitable. There's nothing we can do to stop it, so might as well ride the ride to its conclusion for what it's worth. Yeah. But I would say denial deniers. In other words, they are denying that there's even an issue. And by ignoring the seven-year-old's question, he's basically taking the subject and shelving it somewhere where it doesn't merit discussion, in his opinion.
Right.
So he's denying the fact that he's even a denier. So that's what I came up with.
Well,
Not very good, but...
No, it's a great one. Yeah. It's a great start. Thank you for that, John.
I got one other quick thing for you.
A quick distinction
between the Scots.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Florida, but I'm now currently in Fresno, California. Prick Scott, can I say that on air? Is that legal?
I think you already did, and probably wouldn't be a good idea to do it again.
I'm sorry, I won't.
Yeah.
I won't. But that would be a distinction for you between Scott Walker, who's more of a weenie, which W with Walker is like a weenie.
Okay.
You can say weenie.
All right, I got it. Let's stop right there. John, thank you for that. Dakota John in South Dakota. Hey, John, what's up with you?
Oh, thanks. An analogy. And a little bit of something else I wanted to talk to you about. The analogy, question, is Scott Walker smarter than a seven-year-old? Answer, no.
That's a good one.
And I've been trying for like 2 years to get you on the air here in South Dakota, and it just, you know, it's terrible here.
Yeah, the big challenge is that there's not a lot of independently owned radio stations anymore.
Right,
and
people are afraid to lose their jobs, you know.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, right to work type deal. And when I talk to people, it's amazing how brainwashed they are. They listen to, you know, Lars Larsons and you know, all these right-wing guys, and it's crazy.
What Sheldon Adelson did in Israel on behalf of Netanyahu, buying a newspaper and turning it into the largest newspaper in the country and basically turning it into a Sheldon Adelson worldview promotion machine, is essentially the same thing that has happened here in the United States. We've got five television networks. We've got a couple of major radio networks, networks of radio and television station owners, newspaper owners, basically the media in the United States, with some very, you know, few exceptions, is owned by people whose interests coincide with the interests of the billionaire class, the multimillionaire class, and the transnational corporations. And that's why in our media, you don't hear any conversation about raising taxes on rich people. We haven't had that conversation since the 60s. You don't hear any conversation about any serious conversation about net neutrality, because one of the largest owners of the media is Comcast. They own NBC Universal. And, you know, they very much don't want net neutrality. They're operating under court order to provide net neutrality, you know. And then you look at, you know, the fossil fuel situation and the, you know, the global warming, all of this stuff, you add it all up and it's like, wow, you know, it wouldn't be happening if the Supreme Court had not said that we can buy our politicians. Dakota John, thanks for the call. It's an excellent point. Thomas in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Thomas, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to thank you. You're on my little network that we have on TuneIn. I want to do a little plug there.
Oh, great.
On, for Your Information Nation.
Okay.
And I want to thank the affiliate people who have been great for us on helping us out set that up. I had two things. Climate change is, they say you can't talk about it. And the reason they don't want to talk about it is money and politics.
That's the essence of everything I've been saying here is that our politics are so corrupted by money that people are taking positions that in any other world people would laugh at.
Exactly. And one of the things we're doing on my show I have on at 3 o'clock, we're talking with the director of Oregon Wolfpack, and we're going to re-air it this weekend. So if anybody, any of your listeners want to listen in, they're more than welcome to come by this weekend at 6. Or if this afternoon at 3 after your show.
Okay, so, FYI Nation.
Yep. And, oh, by the way, not really the best analogy, but a little kid can ask Scott Walker, why do you want my grandma to drown?
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Thomas, yeah, an excellent one. Thank you for the call. Kelly in Lake Havasu City, Arizona. Hey, Kelly, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hey, Professor. So when you brought that in, the analogy up, what came to my mind first was an old Bugs Bunny cartoon where it had Bugs Bunny and an Indian, and the Indian gets hit in the face with a snowball from Bugs Bunny, and the Indian says, "Snow in July." That to me is Bugs Bunny is the Republicans, and the Indian is their constituent.
Okay, that's a good one. Kelly, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. That was a great one. Larry in Lancaster, California. It says here you want to disagree with me?
Yeah, the Republicans don't deny that the Earth is heated 1/10 of a degree. They just deny what causes it. There's natural, not caused by natural.
Right, and they deny that, Larry, in the face of all the scientific evidence that says that, it's no, it's real and people are doing it.
Scientists have no proof that greenhouse gases is causing it.
Sorry, Larry, you're wrong.
What proof do they have?
I would refer you to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. You might want to read their last report. It very, very well nails down all the evidence that is there. There are no scientists who don't get money from the fossil fuel industry who disagree with it. All of the scientists, to the best of my knowledge, who disagree with the IPCC, and there's maybe a dozen of them worldwide, all of them are getting money from the fossil fuel industry directly or indirectly. And they're shills.
You guys,
I'm telling you, Larry, the Republican Party has two kinds of people in it, rich people and suckers. I'm guessing you're one of the suckers. And I hope that you can wake up from this, because they have put you in a trance, Larry.
I have one party, morons. You guys think that hurricanes are caused by global warming, but we haven't had a major hurricane in over 3 years now.
Hurricanes are weather.
Tornadoes.
Hurricanes, tornadoes are weather.
Because of climate changes. You think it's because the oceans are warming.
Right.
From global warming. But the Pacific Ocean is cooling now instead of warming. So the Earth is cooling down now instead of warming.
No, it's not, Larry. Larry, you need to read some science rather than listening to Fox News. I'm sorry to tell you, but you've been played for a sucker. CW in Western North Carolina. Hey, CW, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Bless the last caller's heart, I like to say.
Yeah, I know. He's trying, you know.
Yeah, I guess so. And I don't know if my... And thank you so much for what you do, by the way. I don't know if it meets the literary definition or not, but I say to Scott Walker, from the mouths of babes to unbridled power driven by greed and accomplished by the maintaining of the ignorance of the people.
Right. So what would have to be, I mean, if we did not, if we had no knowledge of a Republican ever denying the climate change or that tobacco causes cancer, that asbestos causes cancer, these are the things in that movie, Merchants of Doubt, that Louise and I watched on Sunday, that was just amazing how first they rolled this out for tobacco, this strategy, then they rolled it out for asbestos, then they rolled it out for global warming. Same scientists, in fact. Fred Singer, one of the scientists who gets paid by the industry, is in all these things. If we didn't know of this insane denial of reality by the Republicans, what other denial of reality would make as little sense? You know, if they were to deny that police departments are supposed to carry guns, if they were to deny that fire causes fires, I don't know what this is. You know, denying global climate change is pretty serious, CW. This is quite a ways up there.
Yes, it is, and yeah. I don't know the answer to that.
I'm
Southern white male, and I've seen so many people just get waylaid and blinded by these one, two issue voting things, and they've bought North Carolina. Hell, we went back probably 20, 30 years just in the last election.
So yeah. Well, that's how the Republicans win elections, is they put together a coalition of suckers, and they get the suckers who believe that there's no such thing as climate change, and the suckers who believe that the Democrats want to take away everybody's guns, and the suckers who believe that or who are hysterical about the fact that there's more and more people of color in this country. And so, anyway, CW, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you, and thanks for listening to Sirius. We'll be back. It's 2:15.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Why is it that China can investigate, prosecute, and imprison their fossil fuel oligarchs, and the United States can't? Why is that? And welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And let's see here. Alfred in Brea, California, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Alfred, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks so much for what you do. About a half an hour ago, you referenced climate change, the science behind it, and compared it to the science behind the theory, the official theory of 9/11.
Right.
I know I'm kind of opening a can of worms here.
No, that's fine. My point was...
I kind of want to say that I don't think that really they did a good job of examining the collapse of those buildings.
I understand. There are a lot of people who believe that. I don't know if that's true or not. It may well be true. But my point is,
dominoes and snowballed into the Patriot Act.
I know.
Pervasive surveillance. Our whole society, the whole world has changed on the basis of that. And yeah, Norman Mineta, the Treasury Secretary at the time, testified. I saw it on C-SPAN that he was in a bunker with Cheney and. And some fellow came in, an officer came in and asked, there's a plane 50 miles out, came in a few minutes later, it's 10 miles out, and came in again and said, is the order still stand? And Cheney whipped his head around and said, of course, have you heard anything different? And that didn't come out in the 9/11, the official commission report.
Right, and that leads to the conclusion by some that the plane that went down over Pennsylvania was actually taken down by the U.S. military. That's my point, Alfred, is there's all these theories about what happened on 9/11, and some of them are fairly what's the word for something that you can believe? There's a $16 word for it. Anyway, some of them are fairly credible, plausible. Yeah, you've got and then some of them are really out there. You know, that space aliens had to do with it, or that it was really secretly the Israelis or a bunch of Jewish bankers or whatever.
I think that's the third rail, and why we don't go into it, because we're afraid we might find out something we don't want to know.
Right, but my point is, if an entire political party's political position was that 9/11 was done by people from the planet Venus, you know, something that demonstrably we know is not true. If that was the Republican Party's position, and they echoed that over and over and over again, and they did so because two billionaire oil, brothers in the, let's say, aviation industry, didn't want any other story out about 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't we think that party was crazy?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and can I offer something else regarding climate change?
You got about 20 seconds.
Okay. Jeff Inhofe, the senator from Oklahoma, he chairs some committee on energy or something like that?
Yeah.
He's a climate denier, right?
That's correct.
How about the most arrogant denier in Delusionville?
There you go. So you're coming up with bumper stickers. That's a good one. The most arrogant denier in Delusionville. I love it. Alfred, thank you for the call. Delusionville. I love Delusionville. It's like, yeah, that's otherwise known as the Republican caucus here in Washington, D.C. It's kind of weird living in this town. You know, it's sitting in a restaurant listening to somebody at the table next to you going on about how they're going to take down this union. Or the little bits and pieces that I get in conversation are just nuts. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. Rodney in Ogden, Utah, listening on Sirius. You wanted to respond to our hapless Republican caller.
Yeah, you know, he said that there hasn't been a major hurricane in the past 3 years, and, you know, this might have slipped past him since, you know, in other parts of the world they call hurricane cyclones, but, you know, a major hurricane / cyclone just smashed into Vanuatu last week, and, you know, it's been the largest cyclone within
history.
You know, in history. And California's talking about that this is their last year of stored water on, you know, because they haven't been getting the seasonal El Nino, La Nina stuff that usually brings in all the moisture in the winters that fill up the mountain reservoirs and stuff. So they just keep making up things to say, okay, this is normal, and it's not normal, and we're in a crisis.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you. Rodney, well said. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Sandy in Des Moines, Iowa, listening or watching on live stream. Hey, Sandy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm volunteering with the Progressive Democrats of America in their Run, Bernie, Run campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting together in Des Moines Saturday at 6 p.m. at Smokey Joe's Coffee Shop at 1910 Cottage Grove. And we're just trying to get together and show our support and encourage Bernie to run it as a Democrat.
Great.
And,
is Bernie going to be there, or is this just local Iowa?
No, just trying to get organized and, you know, show him support so he can decide to run, hopefully. And also, our move to amend Des Moines was able to get a resolution passed by our city council and mayor for the amendment to the Constitution saying corporations aren't people and money isn't speech.
Cool.
Like 600 other cities, yeah.
That is great. That is great.
Yeah, good. We need you here in town, though. We need you on a station and get the word out.
Well, thank you, Sandy. Keep us up to date. Give us a call back. Let us know how the Run, Bernie, Run thing went on Saturday, okay? All right, great. Thanks a lot. Great to hear from you. Will in Blakesley, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, you have a Walker story, analogy, whatever, metaphor?
Yeah, Tom, it's from the movie Serpico. I actually got the script. It's very quick. It's a story of the Wise King, if you recall. There's a point in the story where Serpico is really getting the pressure from the corrupt cops, and his girlfriend says, look, I read it. It's very quick. This is the state of American politics today. Did you hear the story of the Wise King? Well, there was this king, and he ruled over his kingdom. Right in the middle of the kingdom, there was a well. That's where everybody drank. One night, the witch came along and poisoned the well, and the next day, everybody drank from it except for the king, and they all went crazy. Then they got together in the street, and they said, we have to kill the king because the king is mad. And that night, the king went down, and he drank from the well, and the next day, all the people rejoiced because their king had regained his reason.
That is
brilliant. You
remember brilliant.
The scene from the movie?
I never saw the movie, but that is absolutely brilliant.
And if you look it up in YouTube, it brings tears to your eyes because, I mean, not only then was it true, it is so true now. Our country has gotten insane, and we have the people that are not that are sane are being called insane, and it's frightening.
It really and truly is. And when you tell a Republican that they're being a sucker, they don't understand. I find it truly astonishing. Will, thank you for the call. Helen in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Helen, thanks for listening to 1470 AM.
Hi, Tom. Yeah,
Serpico is a great movie, and I believe that that former police officer, he lives around here in upstate New York somewhere.
Oh, interesting.
I've never met him, but I wanted to talk about, I think that Scott could get some lessons from Netanyahu, who just won the election, you know, because his campaign, everyone on progressive radio was making jokes about this. He had this commercial where he said, "Who do you want to take care of your children, the future of Israel?" And it was showed Netanyahu, like, babysitting, you know. So he could, Scott Walker could restore his image that he destroyed himself by saying stupid things to that child, and, you know, by doing something like that. And now I know why he hates teachers so much, because teachers teach critical thinking to children. The good ones do.
Yeah.
And that little kid made Walker look like a fool.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Helen, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Marilyn in Los Angeles. Hey, Marilyn, what's up?
Good morning. A few minutes ago, you had a man from Lancaster, California, complain that climate change wasn't real because we haven't had any hurricanes lately.
Right.
Well, last week we had the biggest one in the history of the world.
Yep.
But it wasn't called a hurricane because it was in the South Pacific.
Right. And so it goes counterclockwise instead of clockwise. They call them cyclones.
Right. So we just had one, and we've been having quite a few in the South Pacific.
Right.
Our turn will be next.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Thank you, Marilyn, for the call. Beverly in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Hey, Beverly, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to let you know that the first analogy I thought of was Bob Jones when he got all the people to drink the cyanide-laced Kool-Aid.
Mm.
They knew they were going to die.
Yeah.
You know?
That wasn't Bob Jones. That was Jim Jones. Yeah, Bob Jones was another right-wing Christian nutcase.
They knew they were going to die, but just like you said a few minutes ago, they're in there in a trance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is.
Same thing.
It really is a trance. It's remarkable. Beverly, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Deborah in Framingham, Mass. Hey, Deborah.
Hi, I'm from District 12, not Framingham, Mass.
Okay.
When I hear someone say that global warming is not caused by human activity, I get this cartoon in my head with a giant asteroid coming towards Earth. In the day of the Earth, turn around and say, "Well, we didn't cause it, so why should we do anything about it?"
Oh, Deborah, you just gave me a flash. Remember the movie Jaws, where everybody figures out there's this horrible shark offshore, just outside the town that wants to eat people, and the mayor of the town goes, "Everything's fine. Come on back. Go in the water. It's safe," because the mayor didn't want to admit that he had a shark problem.
Yes.
Here we are.
But you know what? That's because to be socially acceptable in our society,
right.
You have to say no. There isn't a shark problem, and we run around with this total cognitive dissonance that people seem to just incorporate. You know, and I remember watching one of Bush's people.
Yeah, I'm with you, Deborah. Thank you for the call, and thanks for contributing to our dialogue here. So, up next, what's the state of modern Islam? We'll have a conversation about that. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
Yeah.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I'm very pleased to have in the studio with me, Ani Zonneveld.
Zonneveld. Yes.
Thank you, Ani. Singer, songwriter, producer, activist with Muslims for Progressive Values, as in MVP.
MPV.
MPV.
USA.
Right. USA.org. MPV. USA.org. So, what got me started on what led to your sitting in that chair is I read this letter that you wrote to the new king of Saudi Arabia, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant. You know, tell us about it.
Thank you, and I really appreciated you reading it to your audience. Oftentimes, the question is, where are the progressive Muslims? Where are the moderate voices? And you expressing and reading that to your audience was a way for us to cut through, finally, to the progressive community in a large way. The letter was written given that we have a new Saudi king in place, and I was just, it's a long shot, and I thought, well, I should just write a letter, an open letter publicly that was published on Al Jazeera, and that really expressed the sentiment of much of the Muslim world. That is, we're really tired of the fighting, we're really tired of the radicalism, and we felt that given that King Salman is in a very unique position, that he is, given the power that he has, that hopefully maybe it would appeal to him to take the world, not just the Muslim world, but the world in general, into a positive path of, you know, productive use of one's life, productivity, happiness, rather than death and destruction.
Yeah. If you have questions about Islam, what does it mean to be a Muslim? Ani Zonneveld is with us from the West Coast and visiting here D.C. for a couple of days. Muslims for Progressive Values, MPVUSA.org is the website. And
it is down. It's been hacked.
Yeah. This is what happens when we do a lot of media. But, you know, we'll get it back up. And so what does it mean to you to be a Muslim, Ani?
Well, I think at the end of the day, for the most part, people end up staying in the faith that they were born in. For me in particular, 9/11 was, I was born, raised Muslim in the Malaysian cultural tradition, which is very different than the Middle East expression of Islam. And I think the spiritual home, I find very comfortable the spiritual home that I am in, which is so happens to be Islam, but I'm also comfortable in pretty much any faith setting where I feel the spirituality. I can be sitting under a tree and I would feel that spirituality as well. Right. But my form of expression is Islam just because that is what I was born into.
Yeah.
Right?
People ask me why I would call myself a Christian. I would give the same answer. That's how I was raised. That's what I was born into. There's large parts of it that make no sense to me at all.
That's right.
And there are other parts of it that just thrill me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think in age and wisdom, I figured out that I can deal with that incongruity is the wrong word, dissonance, you know, that cognitive dissonance,
That's right.
And function through it. The king of Saudi Arabia specifically, when you wrote this letter to him, why him?
Well, the king of Saudi Arabia, by default, is responsible for the two sacred sites, Muslim sites, Islamic sites, Medina and Mecca, where Islam was born. But he is also the power, the Wahhabi institution. He leads that because he's the king. I mean, that is by default. And that is also the home of Saudi Arabia was the one that initiated the Organization of Islamic Conference, which changed to cooperation and then back to conference. And it's a network. It's basically like the Muslim Islamic nation states of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. And so they get together. It's really about cooperation in business and finance and banking. But it is also a network of culture, and they have a human rights division, which I don't think they do much with. and they have a family, women and family division within the OIC as well. Mm-hmm. But they really act collectively, OIC, much like the Holy See, mm-hmm. In that they are a really power base. And that's why writing to him was also relevant in that capacity.
Right. Saudi Arabia is the home of Wahhabism.
Yes.
Mr. Wahhab back 150 years ago, more or less.
Yes.
Cut a deal with the Saudis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was around the time of the U.S. Civil War, just before that, wasn't it?
I'm not sure.
1840s,
but,
thereabouts?
I think earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Earlier. Okay. And how is Wahhabism part of Sunni Islam? How is that different than other sects of Sunni Islam and different from other sects of Islam in general?
Well, it's very, very literal. So let's do a brief history of Islam here. So Prophet Muhammad died, and then you have the Khalifs, which basically were the companions of Prophet Muhammad, and they basically took turns. They sat around the table or sat around, and they decided, okay, I'm going to be the next Khalif. And then they kind of like voted themselves in,
right,
and to take turns to become the Khalif, to lead the Muslim community in light of the death of Prophet Muhammad. But, you know, a lot of them actually died a violent death. They were basically killed. You know, it was very competitive. And throughout the ages, you had the spread of Islam. The teachings of Islam were taught a lot by women, because women were the first converts. And so they taught students and male students. And
it's interesting, the first converts to Islam were women.
Yes, because it was it appealed to the women, it empowered women, it lifted the women from oppression and also slaves. So it was those who were oppressed were the first converts to Islam. It wasn't the rich, wealthy tribes, and that was who Prophet Muhammad fought against. It was the Quraishi tribes, and they were the oppressors. And so after he died, or soon before he died, you know, they all started converting to Islam. And as far as I'm concerned, they co-opted Islam into their agenda and into their worldview, rather than really converting into this egalitarian expression that was the Quran was trying to take that society to, because it was such a brutal time.
Well, and that's, I think, many Americans, when they think of Islam, they're thinking of some analogy of that. They're thinking of some guy with, you know, half his face covered up with a black cloth, you know, brandishing a sword.
Yeah, that's right.
And so is there a face of Islam, or a piece of Islam, or a faction of Islam that still holds to the, in your mind, the original progressive values? I would say, like, you know, the United Church of Christ, I think, holds to Jesus' teachings as a very progressive church in the United States.
I don't think so.
There's no Islam, no branch of Islam?
There is no branch of Islam that really is as true to the teaching of at its inception, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, within the Muslim, our community, Muslims for Progressive Values, we are, our expression of Islam is very egalitarian, because we believe Islam is inherently so, as what the Quran teaches and some of the Hadith, which is, you know, the supplementary religious text, mm-hmm. which is created by
commentary,
men.
Commentary,
yeah. Yeah. So, for example, so when we have women imam leading a co-ed congregation in prayer, a lot of Muslims come to us and condemn us, so this is a Western creation, and so on and so forth. But the truth is that the first female imam was appointed by Prophet Muhammad,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that's not being practiced in any of the Muslim societies except for us and pockets of progressive Muslim communities throughout the world.
Right. But basically, the men rose up and said, we're taking this show.
That's right.
Amazing.
As always.
Yeah, it seems to happen a lot of things like that. Ani Zonneveld is with us. And if you have questions about Islam, give us a shout. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That's 202-536-2370, and Ani's website is mpvusa.org. You might want to write it down. Let's just welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ani, do you not worry about, you know, one of these crazy guys who want, you know, instead of going off to join ISIS, decides to be ISIS here and come after you and your organization and your friends?
Yeah, it is a worry, but we don't operate that way. At least I don't. You just have to do what you have to do. And what is really important is that we're talking about Islam from a positive perspective. Now, if you want to be a traditional Muslim and you don't think a woman should be XYZ, then that's your choice. You stick to your community. We're not saying you're wrong. We're not saying, you are an apostate. We don't do that. You know, we really come from a positive space, and that is we're creating a community in the United States that is alternative, that brings a lot of Muslims that don't attend mosque to our community, and so that's what we are. And you can join us, and you can or not. It's really a choice, right? It's an alternative. So what we're finding is that a lot of ex-Muslims come back to Islam because of us. Converts come to us because it is an environment that is inclusive. And coming from a convert space, for example, where women and men sit together in prayer with families, this is a space that you can do that.
Right. It's inclusive as opposed to exclusive.
That's right.
And that seems like a really good and healthy thing.
Yeah. And it's also non-denominational. So we get Muslims of Shia, Sunni, Ahmadi, Sufi, all sorts of Muslim that join us.
Huh.
So it's
non-denominational. That's a term that applies to any religion, doesn't
it? That's right.
It's a variation on non-sectarian.
Yeah, that's right, non-sectarian.
Yeah, remarkable. How did you start this?
I was part of a traditional Muslim community in Los Angeles, and after 9/11, I put out an Islamic pop CD. It's called Ummah Wake Up, and I know from living in the Middle East, in the Midwest, sorry, that people don't know what Islam is. If I can tell a personal story, I was on a small plane flying in Illinois, and I was sitting beside an elderly woman, and we had a really nice conversation. And we landed, and we were about to part ways, and she says to me, "So you seem like a nice young woman. What church do you go to?" And I said, "Well, I'm Muslim." And she says, "Oh, I've never heard of that church before."
Whoa.
And so that was a long time ago, but that really stuck with me. And so a lot of my thinking and what we do reflects with that in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And so after 9/11, I was like, there must be a lot of Americans that have no idea what Islam is, and all they now know is the terrorist act.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that by the least I could do as a songwriter, producer is contribute material, not just for the non-Muslims, but for the Muslims themselves to be reminded what Islam is and should be in countering the terrorist ideology. And what I was really surprised was that even though they liked the music, none of the Muslim retailers would sell it because they said, one, I use all the modern musical instrumentation, and two, my voice as a female singer is forbidden in Islam. And at that point, I was, oh yeah, that's not true, because we've had centuries of Islamic heritage, culture, women-led.
Yeah.
And so I created an alternative community.
Cool. Cool. Muslims for Progressive Values, MPV. USA.org. Write it down. Visit there. We'll be right back with Ani Zonneveld. Stick around. Anyway, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 20 minutes past the hour. Ani Zonneveld is with us. She is the founder of Muslims for Progressive Values, MPVUSA.org. And Ani, let's pick up some phone calls here, if I can make my mouse work. Mark in New York City. Hey, Mark, you're on the air with Ani.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, Tom. Ani, it's a wonderful conversation having. I've always been interested in how the religions sort of split up over time. My understanding of the Quran is that Abraham was meant to sacrifice Ishmael. My understanding of the Torah is that Abraham was meant to sacrifice Isaac. And to me, that's sort of where it's separates. But when I did further research, and I want to know if this is your interpretation, Don, is that Adam and Eve were considered the first Muslim. So in Judaism, there isn't a real religion until Abraham, which is years and years and years after that. So is there some connection between that relationship where the first man is seen to be the first Muslim and the sort of hegemony that a lot of strict constructive Muslims or radical Muslims think, you know, that the world should be Muslim?
That's right. Yeah. So the word Muslim.
Thank you, Mark.
The word Muslim with a small M means believer. So when they say that Adam and Eve was Muslim, that's what they mean. That's what the Quran means.
They were the first believers in the a creator.
That's yeah. right. What happened was Muslim with a capital M got created by men. Mm-hmm. And so now we have these different types of Muslims with a capital M. And now we've come to the differentiation that only Muslims go to hell, Muslims with a capital M, whereas the Quran teaches that anyone who is a believer and does good deeds has a shot at going to heaven, right? Mm-hmm. So it is this use of religion to differentiate ourselves, to create that exclusive club. But in the Quran, Muslim is only with a small M.
Hmm. Interesting. So a lot of this stuff is not Quranic.
No.
Quranic?
Oh, Quranic.
Okay. Quranic. Yeah. David, in Indian Trail, North Carolina, you had a question for Ani?
Yes, I've lived in Muslim countries and overseas, and I've had friends that were from the indigenous countries. And I've been told, and I've also heard this in the States too, that there are scriptures in the Quran that will allow somebody to turn from their Muslim ways in order to integrate into society, in order to disrupt that society that they're integrating, that non-Muslim society that they're integrating into.
So this is the big Republican story about Barack Obama, that he's the sleeper cell Muslim who, because something in the Quran says, yes, you can do this, go infiltrate a non-Muslim country and destroy it or turn it into Muslims. Is that the direction you're going, David?
No, I'm not asking it in a, I never mentioned Obama.
No, but I mean, that's the big Republican bugaboo.
Okay.
Yeah, but
I heard it from people living in Muslim countries. This is who I heard it from. One was an atheist and one was a Christian.
So your question is there an escape hatch in the Quran for people who want to become double agents on behalf of Islam, right? I guess, okay.
Yeah, I don't know that. I've never heard of this teaching at all until Obama became president. And sorry, it became a political thing, but to take into a political realm. But we get these emails from anti-Muslims usually that really accuse us of being those fake Muslims or fake individuals or organization that try to blend in with Americanism and once we're in the system, turn this country into a Sharia, Sharia law state. We get these emails all the time, but it's such an alien concept. And like you said, you heard it from a Christian and you heard it from an atheist. And you would probably hear it from Shia, because I think there is some hadith in their teaching, because they were so persecuted by the Sunnis. And you will hear it from the radical Muslims, Muslim theology. So so a lot of the anti-Islamophobes emails, messaging that we get on social media and emails is that they cut and paste content from the radical Muslim imams and teachings and send it back to us and say that's the truth. So we're the fake Muslim. Whereas,
right. Very messy. So. Anne in Ormond Beach, Florida. You're on the air with Ani.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to know if Sufis are considered Muslims. I'm connected with a group of Sufis in this area.
Yes, Sufis are part of an Islamic understanding of Islam. It's a more mystical interpretation practice of Islam. You can have a Sunni who's Sufi, a Shia, and so on and so forth. So it's not like a denomination of itself, or a mazhab is what we call, but it's just an expression of your practice.
That's interesting. I thought Sufism came out of Shia Islam. There's an analogy or a similar group in Sunni Islam.
Oh, yes. Huh. And it started out, I think Islam at its inception was much more Sufi in its spirit.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously it became much more dogmatic, and a lot of Sufis got killed off. A lot of the Sufi mosques and shrines in Saudi Arabia got destroyed with the creation of Saudi Arabia.
Mm. Yeah, and in fact, you don't want to go to Mecca because...
Well, the idea of having to use a public toilet that once was where Prophet Muhammad's wife's house stood is offensive.
Why
to me.
Why did they desecrate the wife of the Prophet's tomb?
There's no respect for that. They look at all these the historical sites. Muslims, it's a historical site, and it's unfortunate. They look at it as a form of shirk, where you would go there to pray in their name.
Yeah.
And
ISIS is blowing them up all.
Yeah, over. Exactly. It's that same ideology.
Ani Zonneveld, she is the co-founder of Muslims for Progressive Values, mpvusa.org is the website. Ani, thanks for dropping by.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks.
We'll be back. Your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day right after this story.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And we will get back to really Scott Walker and the oil industry and what's the fate of America. Stick around. Liberatorily ugly, the good. Jeremy Leggett. On Monday, the solar energy entrepreneur said he would return his Oxford University diploma in light of his alma mater's decision not to divest from fossil fuels. Leggett explained his decision in a piece for The Guardian, saying, "For an academic institution charged with the responsibility of shaping young lives, the choice ought to be clear. It doesn't make sense to train young people to nurture civilization with one hand while bankrolling the sabotage of it with the other." Couldn't agree more, Jeremy. Let's just hope Oxford University is listening. The bad. Ken Graves, the Maine-based right-wing pastor, told a crowd at the Awakening Conference over the weekend that evil homo fascists are teaming up with terrorists to to create a global secular humanist caliphate. Seriously, check it out.
"American homo fascism seeks to take over our land and make it Sodom. We are also conscious that militant Islam, truthfully, wants to establish a worldwide caliphate. They want to destroy everything we have in complicit with them. Is the secularist, it is the secular humanist fundamentalist, extremist. They want to make this their own sort of secular humanist caliphate."
Right. Wasn't that Satan from South Park? Of all the bizarre right-wing conspiracy theories, that's got to be one of the weirdest and least plausible. Kudos for creativity, Pastor Graves. And the very, very ugly, Tony Perkins. During Monday's broadcast of his Washington Watch radio program, the Family Research Council president said that it makes sense to think that President Obama is a Muslim. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Take a look.
"We don't know, but most probably his mother had to have been a Muslim, too, in order to be married to them. But again, we don't know that. But just that orientation, that worldview would be such that he would, I mean, it makes sense when he is overly deferential to Islam and almost hostile toward Christianity. So, you know, who knows what's in a man's heart? We can't know that."
The fact that this is still a topic of conversation in conservative circles 6 years into the Obama presidency only goes to show how racist much of America, the American right, really is. That is very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. Anyway, Susan in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hey, Susan, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much. This is really a rhetorical question because you fight this all the time, but just, I guess my question is, how on earth do we fight some of this ludicrous, insane thoughts that people have? I got an email from an acquaintance the other day, and I was just horrified whenever I scrolled through it. Maybe you've seen it, but it says the pictures are graphic, beware kind of thing. But it is terrorists who are standing there in the picture holding up a head of someone they've just beheaded.
Right.
And they're holding up, in the other hand, they've got like number one. They've got their finger up number one. And this email is saying that this is a secret Muslim signal to each other. And it says, be sure that you scroll down to the last picture. And, of course, no surprise, the last picture is a group of dignitaries, one of them being President Obama, walking off of the stage, holding number one up. And, of course, it just makes you want to scream. It is just so insidious. But again, I know it's rhetorical. I'll listen to your answer, but it's just, you don't, it's impossible to deal with these people. Yeah. They're so far removed from reality. And thank you for all you do.
You're welcome, Susan. Thank you for the call. And, you know, a couple of thoughts on this. Now, number one, the necessary precondition for the destruction of people. The necessary precondition for the destruction of people, whether they were black people in the United States in 1790, whether they were Native Americans in the United States at any point after 1607, whether they were, or 1492 really, whether they were Vietnamese soldiers, whether they were Iraqi civilians or soldiers, the first, or whether, you know, in this case, they are Muslims, the first precondition to destroying a people is to dehumanize them, to depersonalize them, is to cause other people to think of them as an it rather than a them. In fact, more importantly, as an it or a them rather than an us. And that's what all this is about.
Those Muslims, they live differently than we do. They look different. They worship different.
It's all about the difference. And we need to be embracing the commonality. In answer to your question, you know, what can we do against these horrible stereotypes of Islam, is point out that there are some really good Muslims. And, in fact, the Muslims for Progressive Values, MPVUSA.org, is, you know, one of the groups that is doing some positive stuff. And moving Islam in a positive direction. I think that's a desirable thing. Clara, in Madison, Wisconsin, you wanted to get back to Scott Walker?
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi,
yes,
climate
I'm
change.
Calling from that hotbed of domestic terrorism, Madison, Wisconsin.
Right. Right.
Tom, Scott Walker is nothing but a puppet. He has hired these consultants. They're writing his speeches for him. He's practicing. He's training with them. When he has no original thought, Tom. When someone throws him a curveball and asks him a question he hasn't had practice on, that's when he puts his foot in his mouth and says something completely stupid.
Right.
Like with the Boy Scouts.
Yeah.
You know, or saying that about the 100,000 protesters, who, by the way, were all totally peaceful people, comparing us to terrorists is just a slap in the face and a total insult to democracy.
But it qualifies Scott Walker for president. You know, he can show up, he can take down terrorists if he can take down union members.
Yeah, well, the way he handled the protesters was by escaping the Capitol building into one of his secret tunnels. He never showed any leadership of any kind. He never.
Wait a minute. He has secret tunnels the same way Saddam Hussein did?
Yes, he does.
Whoa. I mean, you know, they caught Saddam in one of his secret tunnels.
Yes, he does, Tom.
Amazing. Amazing. Claire, I got to move along.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for the call. Yeah. Keith in Rose Hill, Mississippi. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Landrum, South Carolina. How you doing?
I'm sorry. Okay, what's up, Keith?
Oh, no problem. You and I share many things. We're born the same year. You graduated the Dale Carnegie course, and I did too, and my dad taught the course, as a matter of fact.
Oh, that's great.
And I love the fact that you thank people for the calls and appreciate their views. And that's wonderful. You don't find that on talk radio. Your Jaws analogy I find perfect.
Mm.
And on the, you should put this up on your Facebook page as a poll to see what other people can do and add their own views or whatnot. One of my analogies I put on this is it's just like somebody that's working for
doing telemarketing for a cemetery company when they believe in cremation.
Right. Right. That's a good one, Keith. That's a very good one. Or is this like somebody doing telemarketing for, you know, for the Catholic Church when they're Protestant or something like that? I mean, it's although that's not quite as bizarre or egregious. Excellent. Keith, thank you for that. Rick in McHenry, Maryland. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Happy hump day.
Thank you. Yeah, happy Wednesday to you, Rick. What's up?
Pardon my voice. I've got a bad cold that proves that there is no global warming.
There you go.
But I
it's easy to prove. All you need is an ice cube.
Earlier, given the web, a web page out of the Washington Post, it's titled "The Melting of Antarctica Was Already Bad. It Just Got Worse."
Yeah, I read that article day before yesterday. It's pretty grim.
Unbelievable. But anyway, the other reason I called was, have you seen the Ron Reagan commercial?
The Ron Reagan Jr.? I realize he's not legally junior, but you're talking about the young Ron Reagan?
Yes.
No, I have not.
Freedom from Religion Foundation.
Oh, really? Ron voiced a spot for them. That's great.
I've seen it on Comedy Central about three times, and I think CNN one time. I'm not sure about that.
Huh.
But it's banned already on CBS. I left a voicemail on your voicemail the other day about it, but right. You could see it on YouTube, and you could play it for your.
How did it get audio. Banned on CBS?
Banned on CBS.
They how do you know?
Will not run that commercial.
How do you know?
The web, of course.
So the Freedom from Religion Foundation itself is the source of that information?
Yes, will not run that commercial.
Yeah. Remarkable. I'm going to have to dig into this a little bit. Rick, thanks for the heads up. I didn't, you know, Ron Reagan is a really genuinely good guy. He's a decent human being. He is, you know, his father must have been very proud of him most of his life. And I, you know, I hope Ron feels like his dad still would be and still is. It's just Ron Reagan is one of God's good people. And I'm so pleased that he's voicing these spots. Rick, thanks a lot for the call, for the heads up. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls, my thoughts on the news of the day, and actually some more of the news of the day right after this. And welcome back. Don in Columbus, Ohio, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hi. You were talking earlier about the nature of our country, and I'm reminded about the seven conditions for a revolution stated by Thomas Jefferson, which you also talk about at the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But the first one is the nation's intellectual potential to become aware of a political crisis. Have we lost the intellectual potential?
Wow, that's
are
a good
we
question.
Serious about are we no longer intellectually serious as a people?
Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. I think that what has happened, Don, is that our media, which used to actually have to provide us with news was a money losing operation that was done by largely radio, television, and newspapers delivered to us, turned into a money-making operation. And that money-making operation, in order to make the maximum amount of money, they needed to maximize the people paying attention to what's going on. And that wasn't news that necessarily drew people. It was, things that frightened people mostly. And so we have infotainment, being frightened, being part of, entertainment. We have infotainment now, and I, as a consequence of infotainment, people are not as well educated as they were in previous generations, and they don't know what's going on. Does that make sense, Don?
Yes, and in fact, that's the second one from Jefferson. the role of the press in shaping public opinion.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's and the press now, I mean, it used to be that people went into the business of being the press because they were into that business. In other words, people opened newspapers who were newspaper junkies, and people who loved radio started radio stations, people who were into TV started TV stations, and things like that. Now all of those are owned by a small number of very, very large corporations. And some of those corporations are owned by a small number of very rich families, in the Murdoch family, the family that owns Comcast, for example. And so, you know, we're not going to get reasonable news or information out of these guys, Don. And that's one of the things that really distresses me. Don, thanks a lot for the call. Steve in Navasota, Texas. Hey, Steve, quick one.
I just wanted to ask you a question. I'm a conservative libertarian, so I don't always agree with you, but I just wonder, do you believe that libertarians, liberals, and conservatives will ever come to a consensus on anything?
Well, I think there's already a consensus on a lot of things, Steve. I mean, look at public policy.
Well, do you think that's
polling.
A good consensus or a bad consensus?
No, I think when you ask the American people, you know, what do you want? They are pretty unambiguous about it. The list of things that the American people want is very straightforward. In fact, I've got this latest poll here. I'll go through some of it right after the break. But it's pretty. Here it is. Right here. The 74% of Americans, and that would encompass everybody. Right. Excuse me, 78% of Americans want the government to negotiate drug prices. 78% of Americans want students to have the same low interest rates the big banks do. 77% of Americans want universal pre-K. Steve, thanks for the call. Fair trade. You know, the majority of Americans want these. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old, goat.com, and free-don.org. Luke Vargas is with us, a reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, who is in Jerusalem right now. Do I have that right, Luke?
Yes. Hopefully you can hear me.
Yes, I hear you just fine. So what, I understand that Bibi Netanyahu has essentially been, is about to be incoronated, or whatever the word is. He gets his crown. He won.
Yes, it's really extraordinary just to see, you know, how well he did, not just from those exit polls last night, which were very uncertain. Most people here going to sleep last night, you know, had the impression it was kind of a neck and neck race between Netanyahu and his center right Likud party and the center left Likud party of Isaac Herzog. I mean, again, the exit polls really made it seem neck and neck. And then you rewind even further before the weekend, before the legal cutoff date for any opinion polls here in Israel, almost unambiguously, every poll was showing that he was actually down by, in some cases, a rather significant margin. You know, as much as I want to throw pollsters under the bus, and people here have said, look, you know, the pollsters are political. They all have their own agenda. Right. They all seem to be in agreement last week that he was facing a very, very steep challenge.
Is Israel looking at redshift, Luke? I mean, we had in 2000, 2004, 2008 in the elections in the United States, we had a period of time there, about 10 years, where just a massive amount of redshift was going on. The polls would say that the Democrat won, but the electronic voting machines were saying that the Republican won. Is that going on in Israel?
You know, I am in no position, you know, to make a claim like that, but it did seem a little suspect. And again, I love to throw pollsters under the bus, but here I think the bigger discrepancy was from the exit polls. I mean, that was recorded on election day, purportedly. I mean, that's not old data, and that was off by a tremendous amount. I mean, kind of the equivalent of like a surprise 20% bump from the exit polls.
Whoa.
So again, something seemed to be happening there at the very end, which was unexplainable.
Yeah. Huh. I wonder if that's that's very interesting. So where does this go? Has Netanyahu yet announced that he has formed a cabinet or a government, or is he still in the process of talking to potential coalition partners?
He's still talking. A few of his likely coalition partners probably, you know, just to be polite, are saying they're not going to make a formal decision until all the results are in. They're technically, you know, the military ballots have yet to be counted. There are a few cases in which a party may dip below or rise above this 3.25% electoral threshold, which you need to cross in order to make it into parliament. But this one is pretty much locked up. The math just looks exponentially better for him than it does anyone else in order to get 61 seats in the Knesset, which is what you need essentially to form that coalition government.
Right. Remarkable. Any news from anywhere else in the world today, Luke?
Well, you know, I do want to point out one more thing about these elections, which was really extraordinary, which is that last year the Knesset raised that electoral threshold to 3.25%, and there is 21% of the Israeli population is Arab, citizens of Israel, Arab Israelis, and a lot of their activists and their candidates for the Knesset that I had interviewed had said this was a deliberate attempt to try to squeeze them out of politics, that the threshold was raised just high enough to probably clip one, two, or three of those Arab parties out of representation. And what we saw in pretty historic fashion from them last year was a decision for them to band together. It was out of political necessity. They papered over some pretty intense ideological differences. I mean, some of these parties span, you know, run the gamut from, you know, Islamist political parties to a communist party, but they decided for their political survival to band together. And what they achieved was pretty remarkable. They are now the third largest segment in the Israeli Knesset. They got what I believe is 14 seats, an extraordinary undertaking. And what they also prompted was a real boost in Arab-Israeli participation in the elections. Traditionally, that portion of the electorate has turned out in much lower numbers than their Jewish counterparts. But this time, they came in over 70% turnout, even higher in some areas. So a pretty remarkable accomplishment, and something that they say, look, you know, we wish Netanyahu was not the leader of the next government. But this, in some ways, is compensation. It's at least a partial check on any legislation that the next Knesset might try and pass that they would view as being discriminatory to the Arab minority here. So a pretty historic, you know, result for them after taking a very large political gamble last year.
Now that Netanyahu has said no two-state solution while he's prime minister, doesn't that mean that all this stuff is dead and the whole idea of the two-state solution, I mean, this is what not just the United States, but the United Nations have staked their hopes on?
Yeah, you're right. You know, we could say that this is a big setback for the talks. In reality, they had pretty much already effectively stalled. So at least in the short term, I don't think it changes all that much. But we're already seeing from the lead Palestinian negotiators, Saeb Erekat, among others, that they're saying, you know, this result is not what they wanted, but it is going to accelerate their efforts to pursue, you know, for example, statehood at the United Nations. I anticipate seeing resolutions to that effect introduced in relatively short order. Also, you've got Palestine's membership in the ICC becoming active on April 1st, and we already know there are lawyers there preparing charges against members of the current and former Israeli governments.
The ICC being the International Criminal Court.
Right. And add on to that, some of the rhetoric that Netanyahu used in even the waning hours of this campaign. He sent out a tweet to his supporters on election morning, as well as a Facebook post saying that Arabs were coming to the polls in droves, essentially, you know, trying to draw some pretty intense and some say very insensitive religious distinctions here and sort of fear mongering to try to get his supporters out there. They say, look, you know, we're upset with this language, but it actually makes it easier to make the case for the Palestinians and for the Arab minority in Israel. Look at the way their leaders, you know, talk about this minority population as if it isn't a good thing that they're voting in higher numbers than ever and feeling like they have a say in politics. So, again, the outcome when it comes to, you know, the prime minister is not what they wanted. But in many ways, there's optimism that the language he resorted to in order to try and, you know, stage this comeback is going to benefit them in the long run.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Luke Vargas of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Okay, good talking to you. And we'll be back. Bishop Council Ned is going to be with us to talk about Christianity and religion and government in the United States. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I'm pleased to have in the studio with me Bishop Council Ned II, founding member of Project 21, chairman of In God We Trust, author of the new book, Does America Hate God? Faith Under Fire. Bishop Council Ned II with David Almasi?
Yes.
Am I saying that right? Okay. Bishop Ned, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on again.
Thanks for joining us. I wanted to just get an understanding
okay.
of the world from your point of view.
Okay.
I studied.
That sounds a little set up-ish, but okay.
No, it is. I studied American history, and not formally. I don't have a PhD in history or anything like that. But in 97, we sold a business in Atlanta and moved to Vermont. And the house that we bought in Vermont had a 20-volume set. In fact, I think that one of the volumes is in here someplace. 20-volume set of the complete collected writings of Thomas Jefferson, only published once in history in 1909 on the anniversary of his leaving the White House, the 100th anniversary. And I didn't have anything to do, so I read that for the next year. And out of that came two books, What Would Jefferson Do? And Unequal Protection. And there was a lot of amazing stuff that Jefferson had to say about religion that – for example, he talked about how America is not a Christian nation, explicitly.
Right.
In 1824, to Major John Cartwright, he said, "Our revolution commenced on more favorable ground than the foundation of English or biblical law. It presented us an album on which we were free to write what we pleased. We had no occasion to search into musty records, to hunt up royal parchments, or to investigate the laws and institutions of a semi-barbarous ancestry. We appealed to those of nature and found them engraved in our hearts." He talked about nature's God a lot,
right,
including in the Declaration of Independence. It was nature's God. It was not the Christian God.
Right.
And he talks
And some would argue the Masonic God.
Yeah,
but,
yes. Absolutely. And he even talked about how Patrick Henry and some of the other really outspoken fundamentalist Christians were constantly trying to get him to talk about the Christian God, and he would literally scratch out. In fact, in the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, nature's God was scratched out. John Adams wrote in Christian God. Jefferson scratched it out and turned it back into the God of nature. How do you respond to the, I can give you probably 20 or 30 examples.
No,
of
I'm sure you probably could.
He's not a Christian. America's not Christian. George Washington was not a Christian. George Washington laughed at the Christians. He thought it was hysterical how they were trying to constantly get him to pronounce Christianity. My understanding of American history is so different from yours. I spent some time with your book. And
did you like the foreword?
I didn't read the foreword. I'm sorry. But, you're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Holy cow. I wrote the foreword?
It was from our first interview, actually.
It's a transcription.
It's a transcript from our very first interview.
How cool is that? Okay. So anyhow, tell me, what would you say to Jefferson?
Well, so what I'd say to Jefferson and what I would say probably was that the argument, the debates, and the discussions that you saw going on then at the founding of this nation, where people were saying, well, let's scratch this, put that, and this back and forth, I don't think it's any – fundamentally, I don't think it's any different than what we see going on here today in America, in all honesty. You've got people of faith who feel strongly about certain things. You have people who are strongly secular, who have strong feelings about things. It happened to be that Thomas Jefferson was one of the great writers, and he was tasked with penning – writing a lot of the documents, and so
but if
his sense and flavor comes through in this.
But if the job of government is to do the secular stuff,
right,
then shouldn't, whether somebody is a bishop in a church or whether somebody's a talk show host, shouldn't we all agree that government should not be mixing with religion?
I don't know that government should be mixing with religion per se, but I don't necessarily believe that God's necessarily excluded from the equation. You know, there's never been a society on this planet that I know of that didn't acknowledge some sort of higher being for its creation, for its providence, or whatever. And I think America's no different than that.
Yeah, well, there's a long history of people trying to figure out how things, you know, what's that thing up in the sky? You know, it's, it must be a chariot being drawn by six horses we can't see, you know,
yeah,
with Mr. Zeus or Odin or whatever. Trying to explain things, but that
what the god looks like, in my opinion, isn't as important. The fact that it's acknowledged, something greater than ourselves,
right,
greater than you and I sitting here in this room, has some sort of hand in what's going on.
You know,
in
your book, you've got all these stories of persecutions of Christians,
yes,
and I'm kind of speechless here.
It actually happens. Christians are sometimes persecuted.
Yeah, I understand.
You know, I lived in the Middle East. I lived in the Persian Gulf. You know, I know Christians are sometimes persecuted. It actually does happen.
Well,
it's not fiction.
That's a different part of the world. But, you know, talking about the United States, the title of your book is Does America Hate God? Does America hate God?
No, America does not hate God. But I think that there is a trend in that direction. I think there's segments of society that are trying to
hate a deity?
Well, there's certainly people that don't acknowledge him. You know, I pose the question. There's certainly people that don't acknowledge him. There's certainly people that, well, I mean, honestly, you know, I'm a Christian, but there have been times when I've been angry at God. I don't hate God, but there have been certainly times when I'm angry at him, and that's certainly valid.
Yeah, but the people who, you know, the agnostics, the atheists, the skeptics, or the people who are not Christian and who just,
right,
you know, they have a different notion of a creator or whatever, shouldn't we, like in the Treaty of Tripoli, shouldn't we say, you know, as this country was not established on the Christian faith or any other faith,
right,
you know, we welcome all faiths. Shouldn't that be our position? I mean, what I get from reading your book is that you think that our government and Christianity are essentially one and the same. And I would strongly disagree.
I don't think that our nation was founded void of something internally inside of the founders that had a belief in God. I don't think there was a void. I don't think there was a separation there.
Well, you're familiar with deism and beliefs of most of those guys. I mean, that was not the Bronze Age
but God with
the long hair who says, yes, I, you know.
But I think it's incredibly easy for us to sit here 200 and however many years later and say, well, they didn't really feel that way. They were deists, or they were this, or they were that.
My question is, does it matter how they felt?
I don't think it matters. I honestly don't think it matters.
So then if we're going to construct a country right now,
mm-hmm,
where government works, isn't it incumbent on us to keep religious enthusiasts, whether they're Mr. Modi's Hindus or whether they're your fundamentalist Christians, to keep them out of government?
You mean specifically exclude Christians from government?
No, exclude Christian policy from government policymaking.
Maybe, I don't necessarily agree with that, because it's hard to say, well, let me check who I fundamentally am at the door. You know, whether you're a deist, whether you're an atheist, or whether you're a Christian, you know, you can't take off that coat so easily,
right,
and just hang it up over here and say, well, I'm going to put all this aside, all of my fundamental beliefs. You know, there's parents.
Do you think that there are people who are not Christians who are out to get America?
Yes.
Because of religion?
I think in large part because of religion. Like, for instance, I've lived in the Middle East, and I've got a lot of Muslim friends. So you've got individuals who, you know, I have friends, and, you know, one of their criticisms of America is that our faith isn't strong enough. Then you hear criticisms from other people that saying, well, you guys are Christians, therefore you're X, Y, and Z. Right. You know, it spans the full spectrum.
Right.
I think... Answering your question, America's in a no-win situation. No matter what we do, no matter what happens, there's someone's going to be calling us out and unhappy with what we're doing. Whether they think we're entirely too secular, we allow too much crazy stuff on TV, or just the mere fact that there's too many Christians running the place.
Right. Yeah. It seems that there might be a dispute there. Fascinating stuff. Bishop Consul, you know, rather than debating you, I wanted to try and understand your worldview. I'm still not there, but we'll
no,
try
I
it
understand
again.
That.
Okay, Bishop Consul Ned II, founding member of Project 21, chairman of In God We Trust, and author of the new book, Does America Hate God? Faith Under Fire. Thanks so much for dropping by.
Thanks for having me on again.
Great to see you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of your calls and the news of the day right after this. Bishop Consul Ned is still with us. 6 May 2014, live radio broadcast. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm going to have to read the damn thing. So anyhow, Ned.
Oh, I'm still here.
I shouldn't call you Ned. Consul is your name.
Yes.
It mixes me up. With
my dad's name and my great-grandfather's name.
Yeah, yeah. And so when Christians assert, as happens, like, you know, Jim Inhofe
right.
asserts that there couldn't be man-made global climate change because God wouldn't allow that.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I don't know that I necessarily agree with them. I don't know that I disagree with them. I don't know enough about global climate change or the environment. But I'm not going to say he's inherently or fundamentally wrong because I just simply don't know. That's not what I do. You know,
if 9 out of 10 of the planes that flew out of Dulles today crashed on takeoff, would you get in an airplane going out of Dulles?
I might get on an airplane, but I would think that there's probably
nine
something.
Out of 10 of,
I would think there's something bigger going on that yeah. would be cause for concern.
So you've got, you know, 97% of climate scientists, and really, if you take out of the mix the climate scientists who are funded by Koch Industries or ExxonMobil, it's 100% of climate scientists
okay.
who say that there's actually global warming going on and it's being caused by people. The only people I find who are denying that are people who are getting money from Koch Industries or the Koch brothers, and I find it amazing. You know, Scott Walker, 7-year-old kid, comes up to him and says, tell me about global warming. Mm-hmm. Scott Walker goes off on being a Boy Scout. The kid says, you don't care about global warming, do you? I mean, how could you not acknowledge this is one of the greatest threats to God's creation, to, mm-hmm. to human life on this planet, and yet you're falling into that right-wing cocoon of taking Koch money and denying climate change.
Well, the Koch people never give him any money, and if they want to, I'm here and available. But, you know, I grew up right out here. I was born here in Washington, D.C. Right. I went to Woodside Elementary School that doesn't exist anymore in Silver Spring, Maryland. And I remember us seeing this film strip talking about this new protein that they discovered called DNA. Right. And how they haven't unlocked everything, but, you know, they're fairly certain that, you know, this is going to be an important protein.
Watson and Crick was 1957.
Well, we were still showing this thing, and it was funny because the science teacher specifically pointed out that there's several things in here that are old that aren't true anymore, but she thought it was just kind of funny.
Right.
But, you know, scientists always think they have the answer until something else is unlocked. You know, I'm not a climate engineer. I'm not a scientist. But I'm also skeptical of what people say. I'm skeptical of everything everybody has to say, whether you're a climate scientist, whether you're a politician.
So if a doctor tells you that you've got lung cancer, is your response, I'm not a doctor, so I'm going to ignore that?
My response is, you know what, I'm going to look into this and find out everything I need to.
Right.
I'm going to get a second opinion. I'm going to do research on my own. I'm going to find out answers for myself.
Okay, so have you found out any answers?
I haven't looked for any answers.
This is the greatest threat that has ever faced the world, if these guys are right.
I don't feel threatened at this particular moment.
Don't you think that you should read their work?
There's other things I'd rather read. I haven't read half of your books.
Nice save. Okay. I've been trying to figure this out. Why would Scott Walker deny, you know, climate? Half these guys, there's no interest to them in denying climate change other than the fact that they get money from the fossil fuel industry, whether it's Koch Industries or Exxon.
Everyone's funded by somebody.
It seems. I mean, this program, we're funded by our advertising. Anyhow, Bishop Ned, great to see you.
Thanks
for
a lot.
Dropping by. We'll be back. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Shirley in Wheeling, West Virginia. Hey, Shirley, what's on your mind today?
Honey, I just wanted to call and thank you for being there. I had some comments to make to the bishop. I believe, and I think he should realize, that the reason the church is falling apart is because they've gone to the right. They've turned into a business, and they take tithes from poor old ladies like me, and they use that to buy fancy houses, clothes. They even have the preachers of L.A., which is ridiculous, all that stuff. And when they want to move away from being a corporate business and go back over to the left, where all their money goes to charity with all these poor people in the country, then people will come back to the church. But just like Jesus kicked over the money tables, they better realize it. As long as they're running it like a business and they get big taxes reductions, that they're not going to draw the young people in. And he mentioned the Muslims that are a friend of his. Well, they don't believe in interest. That's one thing I found out from a Muslim friend. Mm-hmm. If they don't make money off the backs of the poor.
Right.
So whenever the church is ready to start going back to being a religious entity like it should be, then maybe they'll get some respect and people coming back again. That's all I have to say about it.
You said it very well, Shirley. Thank you for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Mark, in Grand Marais, Minnesota, do I have that right?
That's incorrect. That's Grand Marais, S. Asylum.
Marais, okay. What's up?
But you asked for an analogy of Scott Walker and that little child.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a pretty simplistic one. It's Jack and a Beanstalk.
Uh-huh.
Or a con man or a thief. A child, a bag of beans.
Right.
For personal profit.
Right.
Not truly knowing what he's selling.
Yeah.
But once the beans are planted, things eventually grow out of control.
Things happen.
And it comes crashing down on everybody.
Yeah. That's a good one. I still think the best one we've come up with so far is the mayor in Jaws saying, go into the water, everything's fine. But that's a good one. That's a good one, Mark. Thank you for the call and for sharing that. Anthony in Houston, Texas. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
Yes, I read an interesting article in the New York Times this weekend that talked about big business creating Christian libertarianism.
Yes.
I think great after the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was fascinating given one of the speakers you had on, and they basically talked about them adopting elements of Christianity into libertarianism and sort of creating this marriage of big business Christianity, which I think the Republican right has sort of continued to follow.
Right. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I read the article. In fact, it's by Kevin Kruse, K-R-U-S-E, and it's titled A Christian Nation Since When. And he points out that in the 40s, in the 30s and 40s, the National Association of Manufacturers and the
Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce got together and hired, basically, a couple of Christian preachers who were willing to preach Christian capitalism. And the most prominent among them was Billy Graham. And what Billy Graham brought to this country, and it was the national prayer breakfast here in Washington D.C. The In God We Trust on our coins, the official motto of the United States, all this stuff, all this Christian stuff. You're right, and it was. I think it was, in some ways, for the same reason that slaveholders promoted Christianity on their plantations. Because they would say, here's the religion, and if you're good while you're alive, when you die, you go to heaven. So just keep picking that cotton,
Exactly.
And they're essentially saying the same thing to the country of middle-class workers. Thank you, Anthony. Good one. Michael in Batesville, Arkansas. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey. I was thinking a while back ago, I've listened to you for a long time. I really appreciate you being there.
Thank you.
The Constitution formed on an Iroquois nation or something like that?
Yeah, the Iroquois Confederation, the five nations that made up the, or ultimately six, made up the Iroquois Confederacy, came, 34 of them visited Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 when they were writing the Constitution. They were there for the opening ceremony. And what's his name? Ben Franklin. Famously got up in front of the crowd when he was introducing these Native Americans, and he said, and I'm paraphrasing this from memory, but it's pretty close. He said, if five nations of ignorant savages, and he didn't mean that as a slam, that was simply how they referred to the Native Americans. He said, if five nations of ignorant savages are able to forge a bond which has lasted for 1,000 years, a bond of peace which has lasted for 1,000 years, then certainly 13 colonies of educated Englishmen can do the same. And
right.
And you know, that was and, that was their hope for it. So
right. And they, that was before the pilgrims perverted them into Christians and all that, right?
Yes. Yeah. This was when the Native Americans were Native Americans, and they, you know, Jefferson was very, very fond of the Iroquois Confederacy. Michael, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. David in El Campo, Texas. You have an analogy for Scott Walker, Andrew Jackson?
Yes. I had a professor in college who used to cite Andrew Jackson's, belief in the flat earth.
Okay.
As an example of anti-intellectual and anti-scientific myopia. And could you imagine a kid asking President Jackson, do you believe the earth is round? And he would of course say, well, no, I believe the earth is flat. Hell, just look at it.
Right. Andrew Jackson actually believed the world was flat? Or was that sort of his version of my pigeon story, you know, something that's a fun story to tell, but you don't really believe it? Do you know, David? Oh, David is gone. David, thank you for the call. I'm going to have to track that one down. I know that the only president in the history of the United States to have fully paid off the budget debt in the United States was Andrew Jackson. And I believe it was 1834. I could be wrong. That period of American history I'm a little weak on. But he paid off the American debt, and because he paid off our debt, because our government debt, our treasury bills, are private savings, it meant that there was no place for private savings to go, which led to an absolute disaster. And we had the worst depression in the history of the United States that lasted longer than any depression has lasted before or since. And it was because we paid off the national debt. Yeah, it's amazing. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
28 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls and my comments right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Johnny in Crawfordville, Florida. Hey, Johnny, thanks for listening on Sirius.
Hey.
What's up?
How you doing today? Great talking to you. First time caller.
Thank you.
Good. I'm not religious. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in hell. I just don't understand why people, first thing they come up with is, you know, God is Jesus. How can you believe in something that no one can prove in fact that's ever happened?
Well, I don't know. How do you believe in gravity?
It happens. It just
you can't see it.
I don't know why. Yeah, exactly. But you can know it's there.
Yeah.
But you got this Jesus guy that been on something day birth, 25 years later, he came out and became a preacher.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. What happened to, you know, you never hear anything about his dad, his stepdad, quote, quote.
Yeah.
You know, and then people want to worship Mary. I mean, come on, people. They need to stop.
I think what's going on, Johnny, and I mean this sincerely, is that there is a place inside us, in our minds or our hearts or our souls or whatever. There is a place that is capable of touching something transcendental, something that's bigger than everything around us, something that is so extraordinary that we just, you know, are astonished in awe. And for some people, that's like looking through a telescope at a distant galaxy. For other people, it's just looking up at the sky at night. Some people find that, you know, going to church. Some people find that when they pray. And I believe that people bind to religion for two principal reasons. The first one being that it's a reflection of community, of shared values, of, you know, this is who we are, of tribe, essentially. And the other reason is because religion provides us with a mechanism, you know, good religion anyway, provides us with a mechanism to reach that state of bliss. You know, do this exercise, do this rosary for, you know, 30 times or, you know, do this meditation practice or live this particular way and, you know, life gets good. I don't see what's wrong with that, Johnny.
I understand. But the Bible was wrote to control people because people.
I don't disagree.
Do the right thing.
I don't disagree. I perfectly understand what you're saying, and I don't believe that there's some, you know, that the creator of all life in the entire universe is some person who is some being that has a human body and a male penis. Come on. This is really a lot. But there's something there, Johnny. There's something there. Anyhow, I got to move along. We'll take some more calls here. But Brian in Matthews, North Carolina. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind?
Good afternoon, Professor. How are you?
I am well. How are you today?
Doing well. I got to tell you, you're killing me. You're like the conveyor belt of confection. Everything you provide into one topic, oh, my God, here comes something tastier and sweeter coming out online.
Okay.
So,
well, good.
Anyway, I was calling in regarding religion and money.
Mm-hmm.
I was speaking with Danielle. I've been studying for a while. It seems the more destitute people are, the poorer, the worse their conditions are, the more the need they have for faith and, well, of course, the chase for a dollar. People who are in the money, so to speak, I know that their agenda becomes manipulation of the money in the religion.
Yeah.
So they really don't believe as much as they think they do. They think it's all about them. They've made it. They've done it. No higher power. So I think it's incumbent upon them to keep manipulation of the money in the religion once they're there.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, there is no doubt in my mind that there are a bunch of hustlers and scam artists who are dressing as religious people in this country. And, you know, we saw it writ large with the Jim and Tammy Faye Baker and all that, you know, back in the day. And but, you know, that said, I think that your observation that the more destitute somebody is, the more they need religion is an important one. And it's for the same reason that, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've been on an airplane, and I've flown a lot in my life, and we hit turbulence or we fly through a thunderstorm or the plane starts pitching around or whatever. And you look around the airplane and what are people doing? They're praying. I mean, you know, I've been on planes that were like that scary, right? And that's the default position. That's where people go when they feel powerless and frightened. And so when people don't have enough money, that what that tells me is that people not having enough money in this society, that we allow people to fall so far down through the cracks that they are in a place where they literally feel like their existence is threatened. And we should not allow that level of poverty in the United States. They feel that their existence is threatened, and so they turn to religion. And, you know, parallel to this, Brian, if you look at religious participation in northern European countries, in Scandinavia and Germany and France and Denmark, Sweden, whatnot, what you find is that in those countries where they don't allow people to fall through the cracks to the point where they would freak out, you have very little religious participation. And I think that there's a relationship between the two. I think that the Karl Marx's notion that religion is the opiate of the masses, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And religion can be exploited by government. And I think the right-wingers in this country are aggressively exploiting Christianity to cause the people to be more docile and to basically do what people are saying. Brian, thanks for the call. Brenda in Aberdeen, North Carolina. Brenda, what's on your mind today?
Thank you for taking my call, Mr. Hartman. I just wanted to talk about Mr. Bishop there,
mm-hmm.
and his comment about atheists hate God.
Yeah,
I'm an atheist, and most of us don't hate God any more than we hate Zeus or leprechauns or unicorns.
You know, I was going to make that point to him, and then he wandered off into some other territory, and I lost the train of thought. But I was going to say, you know, how can you hate something you don't believe in? I mean, hate is an active, passionate emotion. And
exactly.
Yeah, you know, your leprechaun thing is perfect. I mean, you know, you're going to sit around and hate leprechauns?
And, you know, mostly what we, you know, we don't want to prevent Christians from holding office, but we do want to prevent them from codifying their beliefs into our laws that affect everyone, whether you believe their way or not.
I agree. And the other big scam that Christians are promoting in this country, on this country right now, is Christian education, is this idea that, you know, our schools, the money that we put into our schools should instead be going to private right-wing fundamentalist schools. And what is starting to happen in the United States is we're getting the equivalent of these Wahhabist madrasas. We're getting fundamentalist schools set up in this country that are teaching kids things that are frankly, not part of American history, don't comport with accurate American history. And you know, they're teaching them to be fundamentalists, and it's absolutely,
and we're,
and they want to use our money
more scientifically illiterate,
right? And they want to use our money to do it. They want to take taxpayer money and you know, vouchers for charter schools, this, that, and the other thing. It's wrong. Brenda, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Dan in Tracy City, Tennessee. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Everyday listener, I think you're just tremendous, and
thank you.
Sometime caller. But I have a good analogy for you that will kind of describe religion and Congress.
Okay.
Have you seen the Stephen Colbert commercial about pistachios where he's sitting in a chair and there's an American eagle sitting on a perch beside him, and he holds the pistachio up and he splits it and he says, when the two sides separate, the nuts come out.
No, I haven't seen that. When the two sides.
That's a good analogy of the religious separation and the separation in Congress, because the nuts have come out.
Yeah, that's an excellent one. Dan, thank you for that call, and thanks for sharing that. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's up? Netanyahu?
Hey, yes, Netanyahu. But I also had to say thank you for, you know, I listen to you every day, and thank you for bringing us the truth.
Oh, it's my pleasure. No need to thank me, Charles. What's on your mind?
Well, yesterday Netanyahu won, but he won in the way that he took a page from the Republicans. He actually decided to go far right and, you know, denigrate the Israeli Muslims what are they called?
Yeah, the Arabs. You know, he was tweeting, right, you know, before the election or the morning of the election, oh my God, the Arabs are coming, you know, and because 20% of Israel's populace is Arab and Muslim and have a right to vote. And Netanyahu is sending out these racist tweets going, oh my God, you know. Yeah.
So not only did he come here to give a speech, he also picked up some tips from the Republicans. Secondly, back to yesterday, Ronald Reagan, the reason why I forgot what your guest's name was, but he was saying how they had such a great revenue. Not only did, you know, of course, they created jobs, but they also cut my school lunch. I remember I had free lunch, and they cut it. They also cut, well, you know, the welfare, so-called welfare queens. You know, they took cuts out of, welfare, you know, social welfare as well. And I can even remember when I was, you know, going to the middle schools, and they were offering summer jobs. They cut that, too.
Yeah.
Yes, they did it on the backs of on the poor and the working class Americans, and that's how they got such great revenue. Now, the sad part about Netanyahu winning, it just goes to a point that when the right wing, which it does, control the media, this is what's going to happen. They're going to pit everybody against everyone. They're going to make you go against your own interests. I mean, from the time that I was, you know, that I came up in a poor neighborhood. I came up actually in an urban neighborhood that, you know, basically without what President Johnson offered as far as his society, we wouldn't get the great education that we had.
Mm.
And we wouldn't have ended up in President Clinton's White House.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of minorities was there. And that goes back to what I said before. It scared the heck out of white people because they got to realize that this is changing. And they actually stole the election in 2002. And this is what we're getting. And we're actually leave this crowd that brought us to Iraq.
Yeah. I'm with you, Charles. Excellent point. Thank you for the call. 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
A Christian Nation Since When? It's by Kevin Krause in the New York Times right now. Really worth reading. Welcome back, 15 minutes before the hour. And Don, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network in Lakeport, California. Hey, Don, what's on your mind?
How you doing?
Good.
I've got three foods for thought.
Okay.
For Netanyahu, when he came to talk to Congress, it was a cover. He just came over to talk to the Republicans on how to fix voting.
It could be. Yeah. I mean, it certainly looks like it. When you compare the exit polls to the voting results, it's almost like, oh, really? Diebold is in Israel now?
We do that over here, you know.
Yeah.
So, and on religions, all religions are cults. That's a fact, no matter how you look at it. And the third one,
treat
all people that you know or meet like you and they are the last persons on this earth. We'll get along a lot better.
That's sweet. Yeah. Have you ever had any encounters with the Unitarian Universalists?
No.
Okay. Well, I would recommend that you check out a Unitarian Universalist church. You can't.
I know some people that are on it.
Yeah, I mean they don't even believe in God. They just get together and, you know, there's a preacher and some songs and people feel good and they have nice community and I suppose you could say it's a cult, but I would say it's probably no more of a cult than
than the rest of them.
Yeah, you know, some of them are really cultish.
Probably left,
you know?
Yeah.
I'm with you, Don. Some of them are totally, you know, bat guano crazy, but some of them are okay. I the opinion. Anyhow, Don, thanks for the call. It's great to hear from you. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Norma, what's on your mind?
A lot of things, but I'll stick to religion right now.
Okay.
Most people, they don't understand that a structured religion is essentially like a government corporation. Here in the South, if you go to a church, you get invited, you go in, the first thing they do is hand you a membership card, which is essentially a financial contract of how much you will contribute in tithes every year.
Mm-hmm.
And most people can't afford to join these churches because these things built out of white flight. They became structured religions.
Mm-hmm.
And any religion on this planet, I don't care what brand it is, it has one thing, and that is it has control. And they use control for education. You know, like Scott Walker wouldn't say if he believed in evolution. He would not answer the question in London. And he wouldn't even stand up and say, yes, I do, or yes, I don't. You know, but structured religions are about control. And one of the things they teach is for women to shut up, sit down, and obey.
Mm.
And if you made a law, world court, make a law that no religion can be the government of a country, we might even have world peace.
You know, you're right, in my opinion. I think that religion is arguably, you can find religion at the core of many of our world's problems. On the other hand, if it wasn't, I would argue that it's the tribal nature of religion that produces that.
You know,
and if you didn't have religion, you'd have something else. That tribal nature is going to get expressed one way or another.
Well, make this little triangle in your brain. You have white flight.
Mm-hmm.
You have the Powell memo.
Mm-hmm.
And you have no passage of the Equal Rights Amendment.
Right.
You know, put all those things in the same time period, and you have a progressive control of this country. And then if you look at the way the Arabs have moved from just being loving people into an organization that kills, you know.
Right. Well, it's not the Arabs. It's a small number of people in the Arab Peninsula. But, yeah, I get your point. Norma, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Ten minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Norman, driving through Nebraska, listening to Sirius Radio. Hey, Norman.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I like this when you do this kind of setup where you just take call after call after call. You get a lot of opinions. And it kind of scatters it out a little bit than just a regular show. You were right on the money there earlier until you got to the part about the right-wingers keeping religion around to keep the population docile. And I really don't see where you're coming with that. You know, religion has been almost like a garment off through society, and yes, it is kind of tribal, and we do have a certain connection to a higher being or a higher power. And religion has been used for some awful, horrible things, and it's also been used for some great, wonderful things. I mean, such as like taking care of orphans and old widows after battles and wars.
Norman, I think you're making my point.
Yeah, I am.
But I thought you disagreed with me.
I didn't see where you got this right-wing thing keeping the population docile. I mean, any government wants to keep their population docile. Right, left, center, doesn't matter.
Right.
They want to keep everybody kind of calm and in control. And whether you use religion or some other power, some other force, or some other method, and, you know, I mean, you gotta have control of society, or you just, you know, it's not a society.
Here's what Kevin Cruz wrote for the New York Times. He said, back in the 30s, business leaders found themselves on the defensive. Their public prestige had plummeted with the Great Crash. The private businesses were under attack by FDR and above and from labor below. To regain the upper hand, corporate leaders fought back. They waged a figurative war in state houses and occasionally a literal one in the streets. But nothing worked particularly well until they began an inspired public relations offensive that cast capitalism as the handmaiden of Christianity. And accordingly, throughout the 1930s and 40s, corporate leaders marketed a new ideology that combined elements of Christianity with an anti-federal libertarianism. Powerful business lobbies like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers led the way. Generous funding came from prominent names like Harvey Firestone, Conrad Hilton, E.F. Hutton, Fred Maytag, and Fred R. Luce. In shrewd decisions, these executives made clergymen their spokesman. The most important clergyman for Christian libertarianism was the Reverend Billy Graham. In the early 50s, Mr. Graham supported corporate interests so zealously that a London paper called him the big business evangelist. The Garden of Eden, he informed revival attendees, was a paradise with, quote, no union dues, no labor leaders, no snakes, no disease. He denounced all government restrictions in economic affairs as socialism and therefore anti-Christian. That's what I'm talking about, Norman. That's specifically what I am talking about.
That was a big mouthful for a guy like me, but I know that Ford, when he was chastised for not paying his workers enough money, he agreed to double their pay, but they also had to agree to not go drinking and keep their houses clean. So, I mean, he used a sort of bit of control, like, hey, I'll give you more money. Just behave.
He actually increased their pay fivefold. They went from $1 a day to $5 a day.
He's good, though. He wanted them to obey.
Right. And yes and no. Actually, Henry Ford didn't want to raise his employees' wages. His partner, his business partner, the guy who did all the bookkeeping and whose name has escaped me right at the moment, Pierce or something, Pence, something like that. His business partner was a socialist, was a lefty, and ran for the United for the state of Michigan's Senate. And I believe he won. And Henry Ford's wife was a lefty. She was a socialist as well. And it was the two of them who got together and basically forced Henry Ford to offer that pay raise. I've never heard that part of the deal was you can't go out drinking. I think that's ahistorical, Norman. I've read this fairly well, and I've read the Dodge v. Ford, where the Dodge brothers sued Henry Ford at the Michigan Supreme Court for paying his employees more than they were willing to pay their employees, and the court agreed with Henry Ford ultimately. Norman, thanks for the call. Eddie in Chicago. Hey, Eddie, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Hey.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, a couple callers ago, the atheist, and actually maybe it was the one that was heard on hold in response to your guest, you know, all the biblical colleges, or excuse me, I shouldn't say that, but these religious private schools that come up, they're like, they have the private school connected to their church. These people live. They're like
right. They're
like a commune that you commute to.
And they're doing it all tax-free, so we are all supporting them. And
yep. To
the extent that their school is funded by state education funds, state and federal education funds, we're also supporting that.
Yeah.
And which I have a big problem with.
To the point to that your guest had said something about should these legislatures leave their religious morals at the door. Well, maybe they shouldn't have entered the race to begin with if they're going to be that strongly convicted and stick with their own in their own religious circles
right.
and control and have their control over those people rather than have to give it. Why do we have to deal with it all over if it's a freedom of religion and freedom from religion? Separation of church and state.
Yeah, I totally, Eddie, totally. I want to get Kathy in here. Kathy in Minneapolis, listening to AM 950. Just a half a minute left. Kathy, quick one.
Yes. The first of all, thanks for taking my call, Tom. And then also the interviewer that you had on a short time ago who wrote the book regarding the question, does America hate God?
Mm-hmm.
When you posed it to him point blank and he did not answer yes, no, or whatever, his answer, not verbatim, but basically stated that, well, at least there's not an acknowledgement of God. So he's equating America hating God if we don't acknowledge his God.
Right. Which is a pretty thin read.
And it puts everyone on the defense. Like, we're supposed to feel like we're doing something wrong if we don't acknowledge his God.
Right. That's a very perceptive point, Kathy. In fact, Shano tells me that you're going to get a copy of our book, Cracking the Code, today. So, Kathy, I'm going to put you on hold. She's on line 8, Danielle. And all the rest of you, thank you so much for being with us today for these 3 hours. I look forward to seeing you tomorrow, same time, same place. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you and me to show up and participate. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.